there I was, sitting next to the Archbishop of Canterbury. "G'day, George," I said. Well, it was 1992 and the Archbishop of Canterbury was George Carey. What do you call an archbishop? Can you ever remember in that moment what to call an archbishop? Your grace, very good. Well, because I couldn't remember that. I couldn't remember if it was your grace or your worship or your honourableness or your highness or your especially reverent. I even thought it might be arch. So the occasion was an opening of a project that had been funded by World Vision. And in those days, I worked for World Vision. And it was in the occupied territories, in the West Bank, in a Palestinian village. A Christian church there had, over the last few years, been building a clinic at St. Luke's Hospital, which was a Christian hospital, or is a Christian hospital in that town. And it had taken them a little longer to build than they expected because they had only been able to work about 3 hours a day on average because of the restrictions placed on them by the occupation. But it was a big event because finally the David Penman Memorial Clinic was ready to be opened in honour of the former Archbishop of Melbourne, but more famous in that area because he'd worked in the Middle East previously. So the Archbishop of Canterbury was there, and I happened to be in the back seat of the car driving up there with him. Also, there were a whole lot of other people. Gene Penman was there, the Australian ambassador was there, the president of World Vision International was there, the Bishop of Jerusalem. There were about a dozen important Israelis and Palestinians, a couple of muftis and others, and little old me. And as it turned out, it didn't matter what I called Arch, because when it was his turn to introduce me, he said, "And Paul Hunt from Australia." Now, Paul's a fine name, it's just not my name. So anyway, the most important thing for today about this particular event is that the Archbishop of Canterbury preached on a quote that was from Mark and from St. Francis of Assisi. He said, this was his message, "Go into all the world and preach the good news. Use words if necessary." Go into all the world and preach the good news. Use words if necessary. And on that day, no one from World Vision, least of all me, got to make a speech about anything. No words were said, but we didn't need to say anything because the David Penman Memorial Clinic spoke louder than words. The David Penman Memorial Clinic continues to speak louder than words in that community. Go into the world, preach the good news to the whole creation. Use words if necessary. Now, the first reading we had this morning from Matthew chapter 28, it's the way the Gospel of according to Matthew finishes, and it's a statement by Jesus that is an echo of the same statement recorded in the Gospel according to Mark. It's generally recognized that Mark's Gospel was written first. And Mark puts it this way, he says, "Preach the gospel," or "preach the good news to the whole creation." And because this is sometimes called the Great Commission, there's a tendency amongst Christians to think it's the only thing that Jesus ever said about witnessing to the good news of the kingdom. So we get hung up on this word preach. Well, there is something important about preach, first of all. It's not preach like I'm preaching. The word really means like a town crier preaches. It's about announcing, it's about proclaiming. It's about sort of going out into the streets and shouting the good news, that kind of preaching. Well, that's even more daunting, isn't it? I mean, I don't mind this too much, but just to go out there and what are we supposed to do? Take along our little portable PA systems and our, Janet Jackson headsets and... oh, yeah, you've got one of those. Oh, yeah. and talk at the on the corner down there by Safeway. Well, most of you, like me, will say, well, I'm not sure that I have the gift for that. Well, fortunately, the Word of God is not just one word, preach. It's a whole book, and it's a whole experience as well. And we ought to build our life on the whole of the Word, not just one word. So in Matthew, it's rendered a little differently, and it says, in the version we read this morning, it says, go into the world, or to all nations, and make disciples. Now, in most versions, it's the word teach that we have in English. And make disciples is probably better because when we say teach, we think of the teacher. But actually, the word's about the student. It's about going into the world and causing people to become students, to become learners, people who will discover what the word is through their own actions. So the emphasis is more on the student than the teacher. now I work at the university, not as an academic, which is probably self-evident, but in the Student Association, and many of the students tell me that there are still lecturers who stand up in front of the lecture theatre and it's completely one way. It's that kind of teaching, allegedly, where they just say their stuff and it wouldn't matter if there was anybody in the lecture theatre or not, because that's the way they lecture. There's no engagement. That's not what Jesus is talking about when he says, go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. He's talking about the kind of activity which encourages people to learn, that kind of teaching. Inviting people to learn, inviting people to follow, inviting them to become disciples. About 15 years ago, I visited a World Vision project in Mexico City. Now, Mexico City is this ginormous city. I think there are about as many people living in Mexico City as live in Australia. So this is one town with a population of about, I don't know what it is, 15 to 20 million people. I didn't count them. There's a lot of them, okay? And the pollution is terrible. The air pollution is terrible, or at least it was in 1990. Anyone been there since 1990? Okay, I'm on safe ground. In 1990, if you had a motor car with an odd-numbered license plate, number plate, you could only drive it on Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. And if you had an even-numbered number plate, you could drive it on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays, and everybody could drive on Sunday, which meant, of course, if you're rich, you had two cars. Yeah. So that didn't work real well because the pollution was terrible. But it's very interesting, to the south of Mexico City, there's a range of hills, a little like the Dandenongs, except in Mexico City they're covered with people. And you drive up to the top of these hills and the people have absolutely million-dollar views over the whole of Mexico City, but they have $10 houses. The slums are up there on the top of the hills. And the suburb's called Ayusco. And I went there and I saw this fabulous process that project that a Christian group were administering and rolling out in their community. There were three or four aspects to it. There was a daycare center they were running, which meant that for a very small fee, which was income to the project and to the community, people could leave their children there and go and look for work, which of course was a serious issue. There was training. There was a tutorial assistance program for students coming in the afternoon after school, 5 to 12-year-olds getting together and receiving tutoring. And there were some aspects of health. There were courses on self-esteem, there was training in proper use of foods, nutrition and that sort of thing. And there was a soccer team. Well, it was Latin America, there's always a soccer team. Now, is this preaching and teaching? Well, I think it is. I think it is. It's certainly bearing witness to the good news of the kingdom. And often it was preaching without words. And in the afternoon, I wanted to meet a man I'd been told about who was a must-see in Mexico City, and he lived in this particular slum town, Ayusco. His name is or was Father Alfonso Navarro. And we went and had an hour with him, and he talked about holistic development, that is, development that looks at the whole of the community. Or perhaps one should say, in this case, holistic evangelism. And it was an inspirational hour with a man who's doing what he called integral evangelization, translating it out of the Spanish, I guess, right there in the slums of Ayusco. And this is what he said, and Ken will like this. Too many priests see themselves as the hat of the church when they should be her head. What he meant was the priest's or the minister's role is to lead, not merely to sit on top of the structure. Of course, that doesn't happen in Anglican churches. We don't have priests that just sit on the top of the structure. But apparently it was reasonably common in the Catholic Church in Mexico. Anyway, he went on to say, too many churches are like service stations. I thought that was really clever. Service stations, because we have services, right? So we must be service stations. People just come in, they take a service. The church provides what the customer wants, and that's it. But he wanted to transform these religious service stations that are primarily sacrament-oriented parishes into missionary parishes, evangelizing communities. He saw the parish as the place where the mission of the church is fully accomplished, and that mission is a whole. He said, going to all, providing all, involving all, the whole church with the whole gospel to the whole world. Well, I couldn't let that go through because I'd just been to a conference where that was the theme, the whole church with the whole gospel to the whole world. So I commented that it was I'd just been to this Protestant conference where that was the theme. And he said, well, I actually borrowed it from the Protestants. But he said, it's not evangelical or Catholic, it's just the gospel. It belongs to everybody. So there's more than one great commission in the Bible, more than one way to witness. And the second reading gives us a hint, and quite a bold and startling one. It says, for we are to God the aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and those who are perishing. 2 Corinthians 2:15. We are to God the aroma of Christ. And elsewhere, of course, in the Bible, it says we're to be salt of the earth and light to the world. So it appears there's more than one way to skin this witnessing cat. Paul Borthwick has written a book called Stop Witnessing and Start Loving. And the third chapter has given the title to this talk. And the title of the third chapter is Jesus Sends Us Out as Influencers. Jesus sends us out as influencers. And Paul Borthwick talks about five-sense evangelism. And he takes the common question that a lot of young people wear on their wrist these days, WWJD, what would Jesus do? And he casts it in five new ways. And I really like this. First of all, he says, not what would Jesus do, he says, how would Jesus sound? Then he says, how would Jesus taste? What would Jesus look like? How would Jesus touch? And how would Jesus smell? So let's begin with sound. How would Jesus sound? Well, this is the preach word. Go into all the world and preach the good news. Preach or proclaim. But it doesn't have to be the on the corner with the Janet Jackson headset and the portable hi-fi. It can be something quite simple and natural. You know, I, like most Christians, I don't feel comfortable to bowl up to people, even people I know well, and say, brother or sister, are you saved? That doesn't feel natural to me. It doesn't feel natural for me to pull out a little tract with the four spiritual laws on it and hand it to people. That doesn't feel natural to me. But the other day, there was a funeral involving some people at work. A colleague had lost his son in tragic circumstances, and we went to the funeral at the Catholic Church in Greensboro. And some of the students who work with us in the association and knew this colleague very well came along. And after the service, which was quite moving, as funerals always are in my experience, the student and I were walking back. I was going to drive her back to the university. And as we were walking back to the car, she said, I sometimes think that God must exist, but I just can't work it out. So I thought, well, I suppose I'm supposed to say something here. And so this is what I said. I said to her, I reckon belief in God isn't something we can work out. I can't work it out either. I just choose to believe. That's what we call faith. Now, there wasn't a blinding flash. She didn't fall on her knees or anything like that. In fact, nothing more was said. But I think in a small and, for me, a natural way, I was proclaiming the good news. And hopefully the Spirit works. I think we can all do that. Just say something that's authentic in those circumstances. And of course, the more you do it, the more comfortable you are doing it. So how would Jesus sound? Okay, that's the first one. The second one is, how would Jesus taste? Well, this is the salt of the earth question. Okay? You are the salt of the earth, Matthew 5:13. And perhaps it's one of the most stretched metaphors in the Bible. It's stretched a bit on the front of our pew sheet today, but it's all okay. One idea that's said here is that salt is a preservative. And I think Jesus probably had this in mind because salt stops good things from going bad. And Christians can do that. We can stop good things from going bad. But also, I think Jesus wants us to be flavour enhancers. And when Peterson has translated the Bible, some of you will have the version called The Message, this wonderful new paraphrase. Well, it's not that new now, it's about 6 or 7 years old, but a wonderful paraphrase of the Bible in modern English, modern American English mostly, but still, you know, it's recognisable. He translates this, you are the salt of the earth phrase like this, and I love it. You're here to be salt seasoning that brings out the God flavours of this earth. You're here to be salt seasoning that brings out the God flavours of this earth. Isn't that marvellous? Well, you know what it's like. You have a lovely mouth-watering meal placed in front of you, you take a few bites and you discover they've left the salt out. What do? You reach for the salt shaker. It's not always a good thing to do in the view of the cook who probably did it intentionally, but still, that's what we tend to do. And I think Christians are meant to be like that. Christians can oppose corruption and decay in the world around us. We can penetrate and influence the society for good, and we can act like a moral antiseptic to curb evil and to frustrate the enemy. And you know, the wonderful thing about just the right amount of salt is that you can't taste the salt. You know, if you just put the right amount of salt in, it brings the flavour out, and the salt isn't there. If you put too much in, you can taste the salt. And I think there's a little metaphor there that Jesus wants us to capture, and about how we go into the world. Very often we can do it in a way that doesn't make our presence too obvious. So Christians ought to be like salt, adding flavour to the lives of those around us. We should take every opportunity to add salt to life. Oh, and that reminds me of a story which has, it's not illustrative, but it's funny. A Sunday school teacher was reading Bible stories to the class. He read, "The man named Lot was warned to take his wife and flee out of the city, but his wife looked back and was turned into a pillar of salt." One boy asked, "What happened to the flea?" And another said, "My mum looked back when she was driving and she turned into a telegraph pole." So how would Jesus sound? How would Jesus taste? What would Jesus look like? Well, this is the light of the world idea. Light brightens the corner where you are. Light guides us through darkness. Light warns of danger. It dispels darkness. And the history of the good news is that it cannot be extinguished. The message of the good news cannot be extinguished. It's like those party candles, you know, the ones where you blow them out and they go back into light. You know, it's great as you get older, because blowing out 57 of those is a real, you know, heart attack inducing territory. But that's what the good news is like. The good news goes forth and it keeps shining, the light of Christ. We find new ways of sharing the good news. We find that new believers are attracted to his light. We find sleepy Christians who get reawakened when the old priest turns up at the door accidentally. We get fresh discoveries that give us more confidence in the truth of the Bible. All these things are reminders that the light of Christ cannot be extinguished. And note that the salt of the earth and the light of the light to the world isn't, we're not meant to be salt to the church. We're meant to be salt to the world. We're not meant to be light to the church. We're meant to be light to the world. Okay, how would Jesus sound? How would Jesus taste? What would he look like? How would Jesus touch? We witness when we touch people, when we bump into them, when we offer them a helping hand. We in the church touch people through all sorts of things, sometimes literally in playgroup or kids' works and that sort of thing. Sometimes in our outside of the church life, well, we obviously touch people both physically and metaphorically in our office life, in our community, and so on. And every special person who touches our life leaves a unique mark on our heart that can't be chiseled away no matter how long the time goes by. Touch can be so important. You know, I think it's a real tragedy that there are rules and protocols in place that prevent good people from hugging a child these days. You don't need to tell me about the dangers of child abusers, because I know that very well. But sometimes our fear of the few damages the quality of life of the many. And it's a shame, maybe it's an inevitable shame, but it's a shame that we can't touch more easily and more frequently. I remember the first time I went overseas with World Vision was in 1977. And we visited a village where they brought people with leprosy together. And they were all living in the same place. And we just went in and quite without thinking about it, you know, you meet people, I shook their hands. Now, there's widespread prejudice about leprosy, and so you're probably all thinking, did their hands fall off? Because people tend to think that lepers have bits of them falling off all the time. Well, it's not quite like that. When you have leprosy, the nerve endings are damaged, and you tend to damage those bits of you that, like the end of your nose or the end of your fingers or your toes, and of course they don't heal because you don't have any feeling there. And the other thing is that it's actually not very contagious. It's fairly difficult to catch leprosy from somebody else. But if you're living with a leper, of course, there's a good chance that you'll catch it eventually. But quite naturally, I shook their hand. And I reflected later that that's exactly what Jesus did when he met the leper. In Mark 1:41, it says, Jesus was filled with pity and reached out and touched him. Now, can you imagine Jesus' time, what it would have meant to that man for a teacher to reach out and touch him? And I realized when I saw the look on this man's face as I shook his hand, how much he appreciated being touched by somebody from outside. There are plenty of people we can touch today. Maybe not lepers. HIV/AIDS sufferers. Do you know any? Cancer. People with cancer. People with serious problems because of diabetes. Sometimes we shrink back, but sometimes a touch of the right kind can mean a lot and can communicate the good news of the kingdom to those people. Okay, how would Jesus sound, taste, look like, touch, and finally, smell? 2 Corinthians, the reading we had, the aroma of Christ. What does it mean to be the aroma of Christ? Well, you know, I think it's like boronia. Who's got brown boronia in their garden? Is it still alive? Yeah, I've had a few of them. They seem to die regularly. Your one was stolen. Well, there you go. That's a different kind of witnessing. Giving away your brown boronia. Yeah. Obviously, that person needed it more than you did. Yeah. Well, I hope they've planted it somewhere else. Yeah, well, brown boronia is really, it's the most Christian plant I know. Because, first of all, it's not very showy. Okay? And the flowers are what colour? Brown. That's a great colour for a flower, isn't it? You hardly even see it. And they're like as big as your little fingernail. They're tiny. But the perfume, you can walk within 5 metres of a brown boronia bush when it's giving off its perfume and you can smell it. And it's a beautiful smell. In fact, you can't see it. And that's my point. I think Christians ought to be like brown boronia. In the society, working away in ways that perhaps are invisible, and yet the fragrance of our work is felt all around. So, in our church, we have people who are doing this right now in our church. For example, I wonder how many of us know who does the garden at the church? Okay, a few. Yeah, the gardener does, yes, that's true. I wonder how many of us know who puts the music away. I tell you, the people in the music team know this because that's really valued. But for most of us, it's an invisible service. How many of us know who washes the communion cups? Oh, probably people who wash them. I don't know. I'm not on that roster and I don't know who is. I wonder who knows who puts the wheelie bins out at the church. I think I know. Well, these are the kinds of fragrant services that Christians can do. Invisible, but bearing witness to the good news of the kingdom in ways that I think Paul had in mind when he wrote in 2 Corinthians about being the aroma of Christ. So here are these five ways to witness that are a bit different from preaching. Well, the first one is perhaps preaching, but in a new way. Hearing. Just say something. Taste. Enhance the flavour of the lives of people around us. Sight. Be a conspicuous Christian. Let them see our good works and point them towards Christ. Touch. Be the hands of Christ to a needy world. And smell. Leave a Christian fragrance behind when you leave. Which reminds me of a story. There was a traveller whose car broke down when he was passing a beautiful old monastery. And he walked up to the front door of the monastery and he knocked and a monk came out and he explained what the problem was and the monk said, well, look, it's rather late. Why don't you come in, you can have a meal with us and stay overnight. We'll fix your car in the morning and then you can go on your way. So he thought this was very nice and the traveller went inside and the monks fed him and led him to a tiny chamber in which to sleep. The man thanked the monks and he slept serenely until he was awakened by a strange, beautiful aroma. The next morning, as the monks fixed his car, he asked about the smell that had woken him up. The monks said, we're sorry, we can't tell you about the aroma, you're not a monk. Well, the man was disappointed, but he was eager to be gone, so he thanked the monks for their kindness and went on his way. During quiet moments afterwards, the man pondered the source of this alluring aroma. Several years later, the man was driving in the same area. He stopped at the monastery on a whim and he asked to go in. He explained to the monks that he'd so enjoyed the previous stay that he wouldn't mind staying again if that was all right. And they agreed, and so the man stayed. Well, late that night, he awoke to find his room filled with that wonderful aroma again. The next morning, he begged the monks to explain the smell. The monks said, "We're sorry. We can't tell you about the aroma. You're not a monk." Well, by now, the man's curiosity had turned to an obsession, and he decided that he would give up everything and become a monk, if that's what it would take to learn about the aroma. So he told the monks of his decision, and he began the long and arduous task towards monkhood. Or is it monk? Yes, monkhood. 17 years later, the man was finally established as a true member of the order. And when the celebration ended, he humbly went to the leader of the order and asked to be told the source of the aroma. Silently, the old man led the new monk to a huge wooden door, took out a golden key and opened the wooden door. Behind the wooden door was a magnificent door made of silver, and he used the golden key to open the silver door. Behind the silver door was a door made of gold, and he used the golden key to open the gold door, and so on until they passed through 12 doors, each more magnificent than the last. The new monk's face was awash with tears of joy as he finally beheld the wondrous source of the mysterious aroma he had first smelt so many years before. But I can't tell you what it was, because you're not monks.